From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After being one of the bad guys of wrestling, working to get crowds to hate him and jeer him, Jesse Ventura got lots of people to vote for him. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Ventura about his new job as governor of Minnesota and compare that to his previous work in the ring, where he was famous for his feathered boas, his big mouth, and of course his muscular 250-pound body. Jesse Ventura has a new autobiography called I Ain't Got Time to Bleed. Also, Milo Miles reviews a new collection of modern Brazilian pop music that goes back 30 years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. After enduring more than 2 months of NATO airstrikes, Yugoslavia's President Slobodan Milosevic has agreed to a peace plan dictated by the Western allies. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Belgrade.
The new plan calls for total withdrawal of all Yugoslav and Serb forces from Kosovo and the deployment of an international peacekeeping force under NATO command. It also calls for the return of all Kosovo-Albanian refugees to their homes and Kosovo's broad political autonomy from Belgrade. Official state TV reported the news this evening by saying that the plan had been approved by the Serb parliament, the federal government, and more generally by Yugoslavia. No mention was made that Milosevic himself had signed on to it. This was interpreted here as an effort to pin responsibility for what was a virtual capitulation to other political forces. This is Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Belgrade.
Germany's chancellor said today that peace is within reach in Kosovo. NPR's Edward Lifson has this report from Berlin.
After being briefed by the European Union envoy just back from Belgrade, German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder gave his opinion that peace in Kosovo is very close. Schröder said, "We have reached a political breakthrough. Peace is within reach, and we are not going to let it slip through our fingers." Other European Union leaders expressed more skepticism, saying that although today's developments represented progress, they wanted to see deeds, not words, from Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. And many of the politicians attending the EU summit in Cologne noted that differences remain between the Russian positions and those of Europe and the U.S. But the European envoy who helped work out the peace plan for Kosovo, Finnish President Martti Ahtisaari, said the halt to the NATO bombing could come in a very few days. Ahtisaari told reporters in Germany that it all depends on whether NATO is satisfied with the agreement. This is Edward Lifson, NPR News, Berlin.
On the eve of the 10th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, President Clinton told Congress today he would renew China's trade privileges for another year. The notice sent to Congress with no fanfare may spark a debate over the future of U.S. relations with China in light of recent allegations of Chinese spying and illegal campaign contributions. The trade status gives China the same low-tariff access to U.S. markets enjoyed by nearly every other country. The Palestinian UN observer today criticized Israeli settlement activity, calling it inconceivable that the Security Council would not act to stop it. In letters to the Secretary General and the President of the Security Council, Nasser al-Kidwa said it's difficult to believe that all the new settlements are going up without the tacit approval of the newly elected Prime Minister. Al-Kidwa complained of Israel's decisions to enlarge a settlement a few miles east of Jerusalem. Stock prices were higher on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 85 points to close at 10,663 on trade of 716 million shares. This is NPR. Alice Rivlin, the number two official at the Federal Reserve Board, has resigned. In a letter of resignation to President Clinton, who appointed her to the Fed 3 years ago, Rivlin said she's leaving to spend more time on the District of Columbia issues. Rivlin heads an appointed group which has had oversight of the district's affairs since it fell into fiscal crisis. NPR's John Itzde has more on the story.
A source close to Rivlin says her resignation does not signal dissatisfaction with Fed policy. The source says the 68-year-old vice chairman enjoyed her work at the central bank but wants to spend more time with her family and on district business. Rivlin has had a major impact on the nation's economic and budget policies for more than two decades. She was the first director of the Congressional Budget Office, establishing it as a nonpartisan source of forecasting and analysis. As the Clinton administration's chief budget official, she was instrumental in convincing the president to focus on balancing the budget. In her resignation letter, she said it was a privilege to be a part of the Clinton economic team that helped turn the huge budget deficit into a surplus. "We did the right thing," she said, "and it worked." John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
Two El Paso police officers have been fired after an internal investigation of the police shooting of a teenage car theft suspect. Officers Dirk Hiddle and Salvador Vega were involved in the December 18th shooting of 15-year-old Nicholas Huerta. The boy was shot in the chest and head after he reportedly tried to flee the two officers when they confronted him about some car thefts. Two teenagers have been charged with phoning in threats to public schools in Port Huron, Michigan, but police say there's no connection to last month's foiled school shooting. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I will climb to the top. I will become the number one contender in the World Wrestling Federation. The greatest in the world are here. This is the number one. This is the prime rib of wrestling. And Jack, Jesse the Body's here. Jesse the Body's here to stay. You're gonna see a lot of me, whether you like it or not.
The people of Minnesota are seeing a lot of Jesse Ventura now that he's their governor. As he says in his new autobiography, "I Ain't Got Time to Bleed," "I'm no career politician. I'm a 6'4", 250-pound ex-Navy SEAL, pro wrestler, radio personality, and film actor. I only got into politics in the first place because I have a pretty noticeable habit of speaking my mind. Well, of course, the style of discourse expected in politics is different from the style Ventura developed wrestling.
The Body, the most brutal man in wrestling, the sickest man in wrestling, Mr. Money, Mr. Charisma, Mr. Show Business. You know, I don't waste my time with, like, common women. My current date is Stevie Nicks, the singer for Fleetwood Mac. That's my current heartthrob. She hangs all over these arms. She wants to touch the sweat on my body. Now you tell me that that is not greatness.
Well, last November, Ventura became the first member of the Reform Party to win a statewide office. He defeated his Democratic opponent, Attorney General Hubert Humphrey III, and Republican opponent, St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman. Ventura proved that he can win. Now he's faced with the problems of governing. I asked him what his biggest surprise has been in office.
Well, I think the biggest surprise or the biggest downside to it is you lose your privacy completely. You have no private life anymore. And going along with that, not only do you lose your privacy, but you lose all your rights. People can do things to me that they can't do to a homeless person on the street.
Such as?
Well, such as NBC doing my life story without my permission. No input from me. Nothing at all, not accurate by any stretch of the imagination, more fiction than fact.
But you mean because you're a public figure?
I'm a public figure, I can't do anything about it. And where if they did that to a homeless person on the street, they couldn't get away with that. And I have yet to understand why just because you become a public figure do you lose your rights as a citizen.
But
which you do.
What about your responsibilities, though, as the governor? What surprised you about that?
The responsibilities are, you know, it was funny because when I ran during the campaign, of course, I was going against St. Paul Mayor Norm Coleman and a legendary name in Minnesota, Skip Humphrey, the son of Hubert Humphrey. And they kept saying, well, can Jesse Ventura govern? Can Jesse Ventura do what these two people can do? And I finally had enough of it and said, wait a minute. I said, I've done things that would make these two guys wet their pants in life.
You did when you were a Navy SEAL.
Well, yeah, and various things I've done. And I said, why am I being questioned on my integrity and can I get the job done? I think a better question would be, can they do what I've done? Which I don't believe they could. And this is simply governing. And if you truly think about it and you look at what our country was formed to be a citizen government, Now, we've probably lost sight of that. Now we have professional politicians. Now you're made to believe you have to be a lawyer to govern. You're made to believe you have to take political science in college and major in it to govern. Yet our country was formed with butchers, bakers, candlestick makers, whatever your trade might be, that you go and you serve. And when you're done serving, you go back to what you used to do. And we've lost that, and I think that's inherently what is wrong with our government today, the fact that we are now a government of professionals rather than a citizen government. I think I bring a citizen idea and citizen ideology back to government.
Well, you say that your opponents would have wet their pants if they had to do the kinds of things that you did. So who were they to, you know, challenge your ability to do a political job? But the skills for running the state are really different from, say, the skills for being a Navy SEAL. I mean, you don't have to
parachute. Are they?
Yeah, I think they are. You don't have to parachute out of a plane to run the state. You have
to. Yeah, much safer running a state.
Yeah, but, well, you need organizational skills. You need the skill of being able to absorb complicated information. And
really? How do you know?
How do I know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think I've read enough about politics.
But you've never did it, have you?
No, and I'm not saying that I could. I'm just saying that I know something about what the job
right.
requires. And that,
but, well, wait a minute now.
Yeah.
Let's shift over. As a Navy SEAL, you're going to do things that are going to require you to pay attention, or what could happen to you? You could die. You're defying death on a regular basis, so you had better pay attention to details. You had better make sure you're doing it right.
I'm just saying it's a different kind of detail than, say, policy analysis, but wait a minute.
If your life depends on one of them, then another one, my life doesn't depend on being governor. So I would say being a Navy SEAL is far more intense, far more attention to detail and intelligence than governing.
Not to belabor the point, I just think that people have different sets of skills, and to get it out of the SEALs versus a governor for a second, a person who's a brilliant pianist isn't necessarily a good public speaker. I mean, that
right.
one skill doesn't necessarily translate to another.
Sure, but so, this is leadership skill. And in when you look at teamwork in the Navy SEALs, it's teamwork and leadership that survive a mission. It's teamwork and leadership that gets the job done. And it's teamwork and leadership that saves lives. And the same can be shifted right over to governing. I know I've done both.
What are the one or two things you most want to accomplish in your 4 years as governor? Something that you actually want to change in the state of Minnesota?
Sure. The main thing I want to accomplish in the state of Minnesota, like I got asked right away what legacy I'd want to leave. And at first I said, well, I'm not really concerned with that. I just want to do the best job I can do. But now I do want to leave a legacy. I want to change Minnesota to unicameral legislation. I want to get rid of one of the houses and go to one house rather than two house. Now, you can't do that federally. That's impossible. You don't want to do it federally because then one state would become too powerful in the United States. But statewide, there's no reason not to go to one house. It makes for cleaner government. It eliminates conference committees, which is where all the dirty work takes place, where all the buying, selling, and trading happens, and where the caucuses have their power. By going to unicameral, everything will be debated out on the House floor, and everything will be voted up or down right on the House floor. It will put the heat on career politicians, because in bicameral legislation, if a politician knows it's going to get killed in the other house, he can vote for it, even though maybe he doesn't support it, knowing that it'll get killed on the other side in the old swap me stuff that goes on with bicameral. And so I want to change Minnesota to unicameral like Nebraska has.
And do you think you'll be able to do that?
It'll be tough because it's like term limits. You know, everybody wants term limits. It has 80% or higher approval rating, but you notice it never gets voted upon. It never gets implemented because career politicians don't want term limits because that, in essence, cuts them off and possibly has to make them go back to the private sector where they might really have to earn a living.
I understand that Tim Penny, the former congressman from Minnesota, has been helping you, and I wonder what you've learned about making government work from working with him.
Well, Tim is very bright. He went to Congress, and much like me, I think, he was listed as a Democrat, but he really was very much kind of an out-of-the-box Democrat. He was part of the Democratic Party, but I wouldn't really call him a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat. And he got very frustrated there because of the whole system again, the way this, what the system's evolved to. But Tim has come on board. He's one of my advisors. He's been, in fact, he recommended Stephen Bosacker, who is my chief of staff. And, you know, I would very much be not in the position I'm in today without Stephen. And Stephen also was Tim's chief of staff out in Washington when he was a congressman. So Tim is also on my board of advisors. I have a group of 8 advisors, 2 Democrats, 2 Republicans, 2 Reform Party, and 2 private sector people who advise me. And I try to meet with them about at least every other month. And they just tell me what they feel and give me advice, and I can take it or leave it with whatever grain of salt I want to put on it.
What's the most boring or irritating part of being governor?
Not necessarily boring. Nothing's really boring. That I found, because you go from one meeting to the next, and they can be totally opposite, and you have to be bright and on top of it all the time. The thing that I have a problem with, though, is the media. The media's dishonesty. The media tends to want to tell the public that they're there simply to report the news, when in reality, they're there like all of us. They're there to get ratings. They're there to make money. They're there to achieve. And they need to be honest about it. They need to say that to the public, because I find that the media doesn't simply report the news now. They try to create it. They do whatever they can to put a spin or create news, which gives them better ratings, which in turn makes them money.
My guest is Jesse Ventura, the governor of Minnesota. He has a new autobiography. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jesse Ventura. He has a new memoir called I Ain't Got Time to Bleed, Reworking the Body Politic from the Bottom Up. You know, the night that the made-for-TV movie about you was broadcast, the movie that you had nothing to do with and disapproved of, wrestler Owen Hart fell to his death in a stunt which required him hanging from a wire suspended 70 feet in the air. I'm wondering if you think that this was a fluke, or if you think this is a sign that the emphasis on stunts has gone too far.
Well, it's an accident, a tragic accident. I knew Owen Hart. I know Bret Hart even better. I know their father, Stu Hart. They come from a family that is legendary in Calgary, Canada. Their father, Stu Hart, wrestled in the Olympics way back in the late 40s, and just a fantastic family. And I think what's happening in wrestling now is that you have the two major bodies, the WWF and the Turner Group down in Atlanta, and they push the envelope. And when a wrestler's put in a position to where he's asked to do something that he's maybe uncomfortable with, well, he will accept doing it sometimes, because if he won't do it, someone else will. And if someone else does do it, that could cause the wrestler to lose that position within the company, which could cause him fame and fortune. And so that's the downside to this, is that in pushing the envelope like they do, there could be more tragedies, because there's always somebody willing to do it, no matter what the fall is, no matter what, because it's very competitive, and they're out to outdo each other to make that almighty dollar.
Now, you say in your book that you loved wrestling as a kid. Who were your favorites from your childhood? I know when I watched TV, Haystacks Calhoun was just the oddest person I'd ever seen. I was really fascinated by him.
I think as a child, my favorite wrestler was the Crusher from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I had the good fortune, he had a very long career, and I actually wrestled him when he was very late in his career, and I was fairly young in my career, and that was a huge thrill in my life. Another was Maurice Mad Dog Vachon, who I saw as a youngster and as a teenager, and then ended up actually wrestling him, and I'm bald today because of him.
What do you mean?
He pulled out all my hair. He was a tough old son of a gun, and you know, he let you know when you were in the ring every time you got in there. There was no sleeping when you were in the ring with Vachon.
It was during the era when you were wrestling that each wrestler became famous for their persona, and the characters just became more and more wild and flamboyant. Yeah. You, of course, were Jesse the Body Ventura. Would describe the persona as you saw it.
Well, initially when I got into wrestling, it was very basic. It was good versus evil.
The good guy versus the bad guy, yeah.
Yeah, you were either a good guy or a bad guy. Then when wrestling went national through cable television in about 85 through the WWF, then it became more, actually I kind of led the way when I became a broadcaster, because I was the first bad guy broadcaster who would side with the bad guys in the ring. And I actually became extremely popular because of that, and I think that helped catapult the personality to where it was no longer good versus evil anymore. It's like what you have today. It's evolved to where it is today of personality versus personality, and every personality has its legion of fans. And then you combine them all together. If you have 16 of these dynamic personalities, that's where you get your huge, huge fan base of pro wrestling.
So describe the Jesse Ventura, Jesse the Body personality.
Well, I was a copycat of my hero, superstar Billy Graham. I got out of the military when I was 22 and went to the matches one night. I had nothing to do. In fact, I was getting ready to get out. I was home on leave, and all my friends were busy, so I went down to the Minneapolis Auditorium. They had wrestling, and I walked up. I said, "Give me the best ticket you got." And the lady said, "Are you by yourself?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "I got one in the front row." So I ended up sitting in the front row by myself that night, and out came superstar Billy Graham. And he was the first, like, muscle bodybuilder. And at the time I was finishing my Navy career, I had gotten into weightlifting real heavy and was buffing out. And I watched Superstar and thought, that's what I want to do when I came out of the service. So I went to college for a year and then trained to be a pro wrestler, and then went out and basically copied superstar Billy Graham. And where in the end I had people saying I could do Superstar better than Superstar. Star could, and he was very successful. He's a hero of mine today, and a friend, and I will admire him always.
He was a bad guy, wasn't he?
Sure. Oh yeah, so was I.
What was your bad guy specialties?
Well, you know, bleach blonde hair. I was always announced from San Diego, California. Before I was Jesse the Body, I was Surfer Jesse Ventura. And, you know, that all you got to do is have bleach blonde hair and say you're from California, and the other 49 states hate you, because they think all you do is lay around on the beach, chase women, and have a good time, you know, and kiss your biceps and all that stuff. So that was my persona. I was very psychedelic. I wore the wild sunglasses. I wore 6 earrings before earrings were even popular, feathered boas and anything else I could find that very flashy and flamboyant. I remember sometimes the bell would ring and 10 minutes would be gone, and I hadn't even touched my opponent yet. I was still disrobing.
Now, tell me, you know, the feathered boa, the dangly earrings. I mean, in some ways, this is like real drag queen kind of garb, and something that is so opposite, like the macho Navy SEAL persona. So how did you think of wearing a pink feathered boa? And what did that, you know, like, signify to you?
Well, no, I wasn't just pink. I had purple, I had red, I had yellow, I had multicolored ones. Well, to me, you did what it took to irritate people. Anything you could do that was outrageous to make people angry, because in the early days of wrestling, there wasn't, and I talk about this in the book very much, there wasn't contracts. You were paid according to what you drew at the live gate. So it was my job as the bad guy to get enough people angry at me that they would pay their hard-earned dollars to come down and see me get my ass kicked. Plain and simple. And so if I was successful by how many people I drew on how many people I could anger, my personal best place I wrestled was Denver. I used to average 2.5 arrests every time I'd get in the ring. You know, roughly 2.5 to 3 people would get arrested every night, you know, trying to climb in the ring and beat the crap out of me. you know, and then they'd end up down in jail for it. But they were easy. All you had to do in Denver was insult the Broncos and call them a bunch of drugstore cowboy goat ropers, you know, which I would do. You know, I'd say you'd be a bunch of goat ropers, and they hated you for it.
So you wore the feathered boa to irritate people?
Sure. Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, and just how you'd strut around the ring and throw your hair back, and then, of course, you'd cheat. You know, any chance you got, you would hide something from the referee, and then the referee'd come around and ask you if you pulled hair, and you'd turn to the crowd and say, "Did I pull hair?" And they'd all holler and scream, "Yes, yes, yes," and then you yell at them and go, "Shut up." You know, I always interacted with the fans very much while I was in the ring. It was performing.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, developing your voice was probably at least as important as developing your look. And in the WWF, I mean, being verbally flamboyant was really important. And that there'd be these, like, interviews in between matches, and you'd have to be really mean and crude
Well, and the interviews were even more before that. And actually, you drew the crowd not with your wrestling ability. You drew it from the interviews.
Uh-huh.
And as a bad guy, you insulted everyone. You didn't care. One of the things I used to do when I'd climb in the ring, a little kid had come up with his autograph book, and I'd take the book and the pen from him, and I'd stand and look at the crowd, and I'd rip it in half and throw it. And boy, they'd be ready to kill you when you did that. Little kid would stand there crying and... You know.
No, I have to tell you, I went through a period of at least a couple of years when I'd watch WWF Saturday mornings while I was eating breakfast, and the whole thing seemed like a lot of campy fun to me, and it's hard for me to understand how somebody would really take it at face value and truly get upset at what one of the wrestlers said.
Well, let's look at it this way then, Terry. Look at how serious people take soap operas.
Mm-hmm.
People
and you know it's fiction.
People watch The Young and the Restless. They get into the characters. They start identifying with Victor Newman and those, and they live and breathe it on a day-to-day basis. They get angry at him when he, you know, does somebody in on the show and is, you know, pulls a dirty trick on someone on the show or cheats on his wife or whatever else goes on in the soap operas. And wrestling is no more than that. Wrestling is a live soap opera.
Did you ever start at Nevertheless, did you ever take it personally when so many people hated you? In other words, does it ever get to you?
No.
When the crowds are just expressing their hatred of you?
One of the most exciting times in my career was I was wrestling in the St. Paul Civic Center, my home state. 19,000 people sold out. I went out for the main event. I was in the main event. And when I walked in the ring, 19,000 people were chanting in unison, "Jesse sucks." And that was one of the highlights of my career. I mean, I did my job. That's what I was paid to do.
Jesse Ventura is the governor of Minnesota. He has a new autobiography called I Ain't Got Time to Bleed. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Let's get to wrestling now. Jesse the Body Ventura on a rampage throughout the country.
The Body doesn't have to take a back seat to anybody inside that squared circle.
Bo Nelson now, bye-bye, Jesse Ventura.
Wait a minute, at that. Jesse ducked underneath that top rope, and Gurria caught it.
Ventura scooping up Jeff Traney with the knees, and not just dropping him, but slamming him down to the cabin.
Shot right to the esophagus.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Art Legacy Gallery, offering a variety of fine art, handcrafted items, jewelry, and custom furniture. On the web at artlegacy.com. And from Bantam Books, publisher of Rose's Garden by Carrie Brown, a novel about love and redemption, available in trade paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Governor Jesse Ventura, and Milo Miles tells us about a new collection of modern Brazilian pop that goes back 30 years. The collection includes some recordings that until now have been hard to get. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jesse Ventura, the governor of Minnesota and former wrestler and Navy SEAL. He has a new autobiography called I Ain't Got Time to Bleed. You had been a Navy SEAL before becoming a wrestler. What's the difference between the kind of body a Navy SEAL is supposed to have and the kind of body a wrestler is supposed to have?
Oh, much, much different. I view it this way. When I was a wrestler, I could pick up buildings. When I was a Navy SEAL, I could scale them. No, as an... Well, that's the change. You know, I made the change. When you're a Navy, when you're in the teams, you do physical pull-ups and running and swimming and things that are functionable to do, to carry out the missions that you have to carry out. I went into the teams or into training weighing 190 pounds, and I graduated weighing 212, and I'm 6'4". And so I was very thin with no fat and, you know, lean and a swimmer type build. And then my last year in the Navy, when I was getting ready to get out, the last 6 to 9 months, I started pumping iron hard. And then I changed the look of my body by bulking up and eating. I used to eat a dozen raw eggs a day for 60 consecutive days at one point, you know, to build protein and get big and large. And, you know, the biggest I ever was 278 pounds. The differences are completely different. If I were to go back today to being a team member in the Navy, I would probably try to lose down to 220 pounds. I wouldn't want to carry the weight that I do today.
Did your doctor have anything to say about cholesterol levels when you were bulking up?
Well, actually, my mom was a nurse, and she got worried about it when I was eating the dozen raw eggs a day. And I went in, and after doing that for 60 days, I took a cholesterol test, and I was like 90 points below what they even considered dangerous. Hmm. And the doctor said, well, you don't have to worry about it. You're training so hard. There's, you know, you're forcing the blood through your veins. And when you're training hard, you don't have to worry about stuff like that.
When you were first trying to break into the world of wrestling and you were sending out your early photos, what did the photo look like and what kind of image were you casting yourself in before you had actually started to do it professionally?
The exact image you saw. I'd already bleached my hair blonde. It was down to my shoulders and I was posed in a most muscular pose where your traps are sticking up, and I had an American flag behind me. I was wearing yellow tights and looking pretty good.
Would you describe your first match?
My first match was in Wichita, Kansas against Omar Atlas. And it was very exciting. Omar was the good guy. I was the bad guy. And I went out and threw Omar, at that time, throwing someone over. See, in the early days of wrestling, there were rules. And I think that's what they've lost track of today. Today's wrestling has no rules. You can go out there and do anything. In the earlier days of wrestling, there were rules, and rules actually worked to help you, because if you cheated and broke a rule and did it behind the referee's back, oh, the people became unglued and angry. But today, there's no rules. I mean, they can throw... In those days, if you threw someone out over the top rope, it was an automatic disqualification. And that's what I did to Omar that night. I got disqualified. I threw him over the top rope out to the cement floor.
Now, was that planned in advance? Was that part of the choreography?
I don't know.
Oh, right. How would you know?
It just happened in the passion and the heat of the action.
Well, let me say, you actually do talk about it in your book. In your book, you say that Omar was told by the promoter, I guess, that if you were, why don't you describe it?
Well, he was told that if the match was bad, to hit me with two drop kicks and pin me. But if the match was good, I would throw him out over the top rope. And Omar made the call. It was a good match for my first one, and he said, amigo, throw me out over the top. He's a consummate professional, because a professional will do that. You don't worry. You worry about what will draw money. And you by getting disqualified, you keep the heat on the bad guy. By beating the bad guy, then he doesn't have heat on him anymore. So you want to, everybody wants to make money. That's how you feed your family.
Have you ever gotten thrown over the ropes?
Sure.
Does it hurt?
You're darn right it does. Body slams hurt. When people, see, the thing I don't like is when people use the word fake. Because wrestlers, I'll give you the example. Do you recall a year or so ago, Dennis Rodman wrestled the first time? Now, he's the premier rebounder in the NBA, one of the real tough guys who gets under the boards and bangs bodies. Well, Dennis wrestled, and I talked to him after Chicago came to Minnesota to play the Timberwolves. And I asked Dennis, I said, Dennis, how did you like your venture into my business? And he told me, you know what? He said, the day after I wrestled, I was so sore I couldn't even get out of bed. He said, I have never hurt like that in my life. And I said, Dennis, I said, one time in my career, I wrestled 63 consecutive nights in a row without a day off. 63 over 2 months, every night in the ring. And Rodman, Dennis looked at me and said, Jesse, there's no way I could do that. No way. And you're talking about one of the great athletes of the NBA here. So when people say fake and all this stuff, I get offended over that, because let me pick you up and body slam you one time and you tell me if it's fake when you hit the mat.
Well, maybe you could describe the choreography of the body slam and how you can slam someone or get slammed without getting hurt.
Well, you get slammed, it jars you. You play football and you don't always get hurt. I mean, you tackle someone on a football field, you don't get hurt all the time. You block someone on a football field, you don't get hurt. If you're doing it with the correct technique, you're not going to get hurt. And that's what it's about, is picking someone up, slamming them to the mat, and the person, as you hit the mat, you want to hit it with as much of your body as you can. You want to flatten out as much as you can so that your entire body absorbs the shock of hitting that mat. If you don't hit it correctly, absolutely. There's that, every wrestler is a chiropractor. You should see. Everybody has to pop backs in and all that stuff. You spend your whole life in pain when you wrestle. That's one of the reasons why, you know, wrestlers take steroids and things like that, because the business pushes them so hard that they have to use anything they can to stay on top of it to make money.
When say you're standing up on the ropes and then you're jumping on another wrestler, do you kind of stomp on the floor to make it sound like the impact?
Well, let me ask you this.
Louder than it is?
Let me ask you this: if you climbed up on that ring rope, right, and you were going to jump off on me, would you lead with your knee?
No way.
but if you hit me, you'd be okay, right? But what if I roll out of the way?
Right.
It's also self-protection.
Uh-huh.
You want to deliver the blow, but you want to deliver it with self-protection, not hurt yourself when you do it. Because if you jump off and lead with your knee and that guy rolls out of the way, you're going to bury your knee right in that mat. So naturally, you cushion. It's called self-preservation. You got to wrestle the next night, too.
My guest is Jesse Ventura, the governor of Minnesota. He has a new autobiography. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jesse Ventura, former wrestler, now the governor of Minnesota. You've told us a little bit about who your heroes were when you were young, who your wrestling heroes were. Who have been your political heroes over the years? Who have you admired?
I don't think I've ever really had a political hero. My father was very vocal. He disliked all politicians. And, you know, he would make that very vocal at the dinner table a lot at night. So I was kind of sordid and twisted and never really cared for politicians a whole lot when I grew up. My hero of heroes was Muhammad Ali. He was the hero that I, you know, have admired my entire life, but because he's a man who stood up for his convictions, even though I'm a veteran, Muhammad chose not to be, but he gave up everything in belief of his convictions, and I greatly admire anyone who will do that. But in politics, I really don't have a hero, I don't think. I don't think there's anyone I can name and say. I think my hero today would be Governor Angus King from Maine. He's the other independent governor who's 4 years ahead of me. So he's been where I am and done that. So when I need to consult someone, I call Angus.
You know, the problem people always assume that an independent governor would have is that he has no particular sway with either Democrats or Republicans in the legislature, and it's going to be very difficult to get anything passed. Are you having troubles like that?
They posture that way. But see, being an independent means you're a centrist. Like, I'm fiscally conservative, but I'm socially liberal, which puts me as a centrist in the middle, which is where I think 70% of people really are. Well, what happens during this, during the process, is you've got the far right, the Republicans, you have the far left, the Democrats, but when it gets to brass tacks time, where do they end up? Central. They have to compromise. They have to come to the middle, so they end up coming right where I sit. So I end up getting the credit for it. It's great, because I can sit as a centrist and a common sense point of view, and the far right and far left have to come to me eventually. They have nowhere else to go when the compromise has to be met between the two caucuses.
You know, a lot of people say politics is about the art of compromise. And I'm wondering how much experience you feel you've had with the art of compromise coming from the wrestling world, where it's about winning and losing, and also about, like you said, being the bad guy and getting people to really hate you and stirring up crowds. You know, compromise and is a really different way of looking at the world.
Yeah, but let me tell you this. When you've dealt with Vince McMahon, there's not a politician. There's not a politician in the world that's any more savvy than he is. And even more so than him was his father, Vince McMahon Sr. He was the kind of guy who you'd be so angry, you'd walk into him, you'd yell and holler. He'd speak very softly to you. You'd walk out. You would have gained nothing, but you felt good. And then an hour later, you're angry because you realized, boy, did he swerve me. And so in dealing with those type of promoters, I find that they're in the private sector where I've dealt, they are just as it's just as big of a shark world as anything in politics. I feel I'm fully qualified to deal with these people.
And Vince McMahon is the head of the World Wrestling Federation.
Right, but I actually worked for his father, Vince Sr., before him, who was even more smooth. Vinny Jr. ain't nothing compared to Vinny Sr.
You know, Garrison Keillor, who hosts the public radio program A Prairie Home Companion, wrote a satirical book based on you about a wrestler who becomes a governor. And I'm wondering if you've read the book.
No.
One of the things that Garrison said when I interviewed him about your book was, how can you not be astonished and amused at this man's ability to stand up and say things that a lot of people secretly think and wouldn't say? This is what we elect performers for. They go out on stage and they say things right out in the open that we don't dare say because we're very nice people. Do you think that's true?
Might be, but and I take that as a compliment. You know, Mr. Keillor's very successful at what he does. He's a very bright man, and I haven't read his book because I preferred to write mine. His is imagination, mine is truth.
I'm wondering if you think that it might be true that you say things that people secretly think and wouldn't say. What might those things be?
Well, on many issues, one of the speeches, the greatest speech that I attribute in the film world is by Jack Nicholson in the film A Few Good Men, when he's on the stand and Tom Cruise demands, "I want the truth." And Jack Nicholson says, "You can't handle the truth." And if you listen, I listen to that speech about once every 2 weeks. And I listen to it because what Jack is saying is the truth, that the public and many people can't handle the truth. And when you give them the truth, and the media can't handle the truth all the time. And yet they question the people that provide the freedom, just like Jack says in his speech. And, you know, and I find that to be very, very profound, what Nicholson's speech, and I listen to it quite often, like I said, because I think that that's very true of my position. The fact that I will tell the truth, and the fact that many people, when they hear the truth, can't handle it. They would rather be told something that is untruthful, but something to where they can somehow deal with it.
The title of your book, I Ain't Got Time to Bleed, is taken from one of your lines in the film Predator.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's particularly after the shootings in Littleton, some people have said it's really time for the media to stop making so many violent movies, and there should be more government pressure on the media to stop making such violent programming. And I'm wondering your thoughts about that. Is there too much violence in the media?
Well, my thoughts are it's time for parents to start parenting. It is not government's job to raise your kids. It's not government's job to tell you what your kids should watch on TV. it's your job as a parent. And it's easy to use a scapegoat and say that, you know, violence in the movies cause it, video games cause it, this causes it, that causes it. It's called lack of parenting and lack of getting involved in loving your children that causes it. And you need look no farther than in the mirror. Like, I was criticized over this book. They said, how could you say the things you say when you are a role model to so many young people? And I said, because I tell them the truth. Because at age 18 and 19, sure, I did things. No one at 18 or 19 makes a decision based upon that you might be a role model 25 years later. But I do tell the truth, and I believe the truth should always be told, and it's what the young people are demanding from us. Not hypocrisy, but the truth.
No, I think you said after the shootings in Littleton that it showed that people should be allowed to carry weapons to protect themselves. Would that have
No,
been...
I didn't say that. What I said, I got asked three times by the media.
Uh-huh.
They came up to me, and I'm the kind of person, see, this is one of my faults in politics. I'm the kind of person, when I get asked a question, I try to answer it. And that can lead you to trouble. Because, and so what happened that particular day was the third time they asked me how I felt about the conceal and carry law being withdrawn from the Colorado floor. It was due to be debated, and in light of what the tragedy that happened, they pulled it from the floor, which I could understand. It was the wrong time to discuss a situation like that, and it was the wrong time for me to comment on it. I should have not commented, but all I simply stated was this, that had there been a licensed conceal and carry person, and that doesn't mean a kid, it doesn't mean a child, I mean a licensed conceal and carry, had there been one in that building, there is a good chance lives could have been saved. Because rest assured, what you had here was an act of complete cowardly terrorism, of innocent people being unmercifully assassinated and killed in cold blood. Well, you're not going to, you can't deal with people like this by talking to them. That's out of the question at that point. And that's all I stated was, had there been someone there, just like when that guy went crazy on the New York subway. Well, imagine if somebody was there, who a law-abiding person, that could stop these people before more carnage is done. Because let's remember something. The police come after the fact. The police, how many, you go up to a 30-year police veteran and ask him how many crimes he's stopped in progress. And he'll probably be lucky to tell you one or two. And if you ask him, well, how did that happen? He'll say, sheer luck. I happened to turn left on this street. And it happened. You know, police come after the fact. So the point I'm making is people somehow believe the government can protect you. The government cannot protect you. The government comes after the fact.
You know what really confuses me? I know that you don't hold government in the highest regard and that you'd like to
see less
of it rather
than more. Oh, yes, I do. I'm very patriotic.
Okay. Because I always wonder, when people don't really like government and they want much less of it, why they would enter it in the first place.
To make much less of it. How are you going to do so? How, you can't change the system on the outside, Terry. You can only change it from the inside. You can complain all you want on the outside of the system, that's not going to change it one bit. The only way to change the system is to become part of the system and change it from the inside.
Do you think you're going to want to stay in politics?
No, I absolutely won't, because I'm a firm believer, like I said, that people should come from the private sector, serve, and go back to what they used to do.
Well, you're not going to go back into wrestling, but maybe other aspects of performing?
Who knows? I may retire. I will do this term, and I will do, I haven't decided if I'll do a second term, but I will never serve more than 2 4-year terms, because I don't believe anyone should be allowed to serve more than we allow the president.
Do you ever watch wrestling anymore?
Not very much.
No time or no interest?
Both. Both.
How come you're not interested anymore?
Because I don't work in it and I don't make money at it, and because I'm more interested, if I have a choice between that and NBA basketball, I'll watch basketball.
Well, Jesse Ventura, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It was my pleasure, and hopefully we'll do it again.
Jesse Ventura is the governor of Minnesota. His new autobiography is called I Ain't Got Time to Bleed. Here's music from the group People Like Us, which is led by pianist and composer Joel Forrester, who wrote the Fresh Air theme. This is Joel's composition, Your Political Movie. ¶¶ Coming up, Milo Miles reviews a new collection of Brazilian pop. This is Fresh Air. Sometimes listening to a new CD takes an unexpected turn. This happened to music critic Milo Miles when a new box set became a door to Brazilian and American history.
Late last year, Brazilian Polygram released a 5-CD box set called Tropicália 30 Anos. It was the first time that several key albums by the founders of modern Brazilian pop music, called MPB, had been halfway easy to find in the United States. The collection includes the second albums by superstars Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil, another where singer Gal Costa becomes her mature self, the debut of the fascinating rock band Os Mutantes, and finally, the collective manifesto album called Just Tropicália. Insiders have muttered reverently about these albums for ages. Serious fans of Brazilian pop, or even world music in general, should own the box. And that's all the consumer guiding and regular reviewing I'm going to do here, because Tropicália 30 Anos has a curious effect that goes beyond being a simple, good collection of music. Since four of the albums were released in 1968 and one in 1969, the set might suggest a time capsule, but it's nothing so sterile and inert. Instead, I'll argue that Tropicália 30 Anos is the real doorway to the 60s that American culture has been struggling to open recently with no success. Everything from political rhetoric to overexposed vintage rock on the radio to dreadful television shows have made the 1960s seem completely unreachable. The period's symbols, sounds, personalities, and events have become no more palpable than tales of Camelot or the Alamo. Some preserved reporting from Vietnam breaks through, but that's about it. In Brazil, the Tropicália movement of 1967 and 1968 was a spontaneous combustion of youth, mass media, and expanded consciousness. The tunes used electric guitars to play ancient folk songs. The lyrics mixed florid poetry and vulgarity. The performers dressed in exuberant costumes that were at once political statements and walking art. The music was supposed to be about establishing a new, authentically Brazilian identity, yet it owed everything to the Beatles and American soul. Yes, it's a remarkable parallel to the cultural upheaval in this country going on at the same time, though the Brazilian government cracked down much harder and effectively muted this bunch of folk rock and hippies for years after 1969. But because the sounds they made in their moment of freedom haven't been trumpeted and trounced, praised and damned until they are totally hollowed out, their particular vitality can still hit hard. You hear youth who know they are new creatures in a new universe. You hear modernity that is a chaotic carnival of choices, not just a cold, alienating encroachment on romantic humanism. Listening to these albums, events in America from the same period come closer, seething with promise and fear, simply because people elsewhere were going through the same changes in their own way. Tropicália 30 Anos opens a captivating window into the past of Brazil. Who knew it would work as a mirror for Americans as well?
Milo Miles is music editor at Soundstone.com. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolf. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Você precisa saber da piscina, da margarina, da carolina, da gasolina. Você precisa saber de mim. Baby, precisa tomar sorvete na lanchonete, andar com a gente, me ver de perto, ouvir aquela canção do Roberto.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, call 877-21-FRESH. That's 877-213-7374. Fresh Air is also available online at audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, designing cars with a philosophy that performance and safety should go hand in hand. Information available at www.saabusa.com. And Little Brown & Company, publishers of Brief Interviews with Hideous Men, Stories by David Foster Wallace. Available in hardcover and as a Time Warner audiobook. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, actress and acting teacher Uta Hagen. She's getting a special Tony Award Sunday night. We'll hear what the American theater was like when she started her career over 60 years ago. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.